Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 6th of June. Ukraine confirms it's begun offensive operations against the Russian occupiers and made gains around Bakhmut.
The enemy knows that Ukraine will win. They see it. They feel it. Thanks to your strikes, warriors. Thank you for that.
Russia says it's halted all attempted advances. We'll assess what's going on. Apple launches its first new product in 8 years, but can an augmented reality headset really supplant the iPhone? And we have a special report on the devastating mental health cost of Taliban rule in Afghanistan. Also in the podcast, the World Health Organization announces plans for a global health certificate and... The secret language of forbidden love reflected in new sea shanties. Ukraine has been adamant that it will not announce the start of its much-heralded counter-offensive against the Russian occupiers. But it is now clear that Ukrainian forces are stepping up attacks in the eastern Donbass. According to the government, they've made gains around the battlefield city of Bakhmut, a claim partially backed up by Russian bloggers and by the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in his nightly address to the nation.
Firstly, I am grateful to every one of our soldiers, all our defenders who during this day have provided the news we have been waiting for from Bakhmut. Well done, warriors. The enemy knows that Ukraine will win. They see it, thanks to your strikes, warriors, especially in the Donetsk region.
Well, our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse looks back at Monday's developments from Kiev.
You could say Ukraine has reveled in its strategy of trying to keep Russia guessing. Kiev's latest online video showed soldiers putting their index fingers to their lips. The caption reads, "Plans love silence." To give you an idea of what those plans might be, last week's film was titled, "It's Time to Take Back What's Ours." Early this morning, Russia's defense ministry said it had thwarted a major Ukrainian attack in Donetsk. Anamalia has now said offensive actions are beginning. She described the eastern city of Bakhmut as the epicenter of hostilities and claimed Russian forces were on the defensive there as well as in the south. A senior Ukrainian general said troops were moving forward towards the city. According to Yuri Sak, an advisor for Ukraine's defense ministry, a new offensive was never going to come with an announcement.
Counteroffensive is not an event where all Ukrainian armed forces, our tanks, our ground forces gather in one place, then they wait for the starting gun, and then everybody charges towards the defense lines of the enemy. So we will not be making any specific announcement about the next stages, but we will all see them as they happen.
This isn't business as usual on the front line. Ukrainian forces have been attacking different areas with newly trained troops. They claim to have made small gains in two areas. Russia says it's repelled major offensives in the Luhansk, Donetsk and Zaporizhia regions. When you look at the unusual level of military activity on the Ukrainian side, the heightened rhetoric and Russian forces being pulled in more directions, the evidence suggests Kyiv is in the early stages of its anticipated counteroffensive.
James Waterhouse. General John Allen is a former commander of NATO and US forces in Afghanistan. He told Evan Davis that Ukraine's counteroffensive has been in the preparatory so-called shaping phase for weeks.
The shaping phase, of course, sets the conditions ultimately for when the maneuver phase begins for it to be as successful as possible. And so for weeks, what the Ukrainians have been doing is reconnoitering the Russian positions to ensure they understand what the strengths are on the front lines. There are fires going in along the front to get a sense of the Russian reactions. And they've been shaping the information space as well. So part of the shaping phase, Evan, has been a deception plan. There's always a deception plan for something like this. And you want to either convince your opponent of one specific thing or multiple things that dissipates his attention across various areas. So all of that has been occurring up to this point.
The front lines, hundreds of miles, it's been explained they're not going to suddenly blow a whistle and everybody's going to move forward the whole way through. What exactly are we talking about?
Most of these Russian forces on the lines have not been off the line in months and months. Many of them have been decimated. And so the Ukrainians are attempting to assess where the greatest weaknesses are, but also assess what axes would produce the most likely success when the actual physical movement and the maneuver phase begins. They'll be coming over probably several axes, and the Russians will have to deal with that.
Why are we talking about a Ukrainian spring offensive and not a Russian spring offensive? Is Russia now just too weak to actually properly advance in any big way?
That's a pretty good summary, actually. And the Russians attempted a winter offensive last year. Roughly five division equivalent formations went at the Ukrainians from the end of 22 into early 23 and accomplished almost nothing except enormous casualties and a lot of equipment loss. The Russians have attempted to anticipate where these thrusts will come by the Ukrainians and built complex obstacle belts behind the front lines that might slow a breakthrough if the Ukrainians have a breakthrough. And frankly, I think the Ukrainians are going to have multiple breakthroughs. The question is, are they going to be able to exploit those breakthroughs when they have them? This is not a Napoleonic decisive knockout blow, so to speak. They just don't have the combat power for that. This is going to be the first of probably several really substantial counteroffensives as the Ukrainians go forward. All of these successful moves, to include the successful defense last year against the Russian counteroffensive and generally the success around Bakhmut, all of these things contribute to creating the narrative that likely Russia could lose this and sets the narrative for the potential for serious peace talks going forward on Ukrainian terms.
General John Allen talking to Evan Davis. A former FBI agent who admitted spying for Russia has been found dead in prison in the US at the age of 79. Robert Hansen was arrested in 2001 for selling highly classified material, including nuclear secrets, to the Soviet Union and later to Russia. He was serving 15 consecutive life sentences at a maximum security facility in Colorado. Here's our North America correspondent, Nomia Iqbal.
Robert Hansen was considered one of the most damaging spies in American history. He joined the FBI in 1979 and 3 years in approached the former Soviet Union and began spying. He stopped when his wife confronted him, but then resumed criminal activity in 1985, selling thousands of classified documents. Using the alias Ramon Garcia, he had received more than $1.4 million in cash, diamonds and money paid into Russian accounts. Eventually, he was caught after the FBI had been tracking him for months. Officials at the Supermax prison in Colorado say staff found Robert Hansen unresponsive and immediately initiated life-saving measures. The cause of death has yet to be confirmed.
Nomia Iqbal. Now, it may look like a pair of ski goggles, but Apple is pinning its hopes on the augmented reality headset that it launched on Monday. The firm's first brand new product for 8 years, it enables users to experience virtual reality or view real life with digital objects layered on top. The tech giant has invested a lot of money in trying to find a product line to replace the iPhone. But the headset comes at a cost of $3,500. So how will it go down? Our correspondent James Clayton is at the firm's annual developers conference near San Francisco.
First of all, it's worth mentioning, we haven't had a chance to look at it yet. It's not going to be available till 2024 to be on the market. So it's very difficult to comment on what it actually feels and looks like. But it's like a slimmed down version of a classic VR headset. It's got frontward facing cameras, which allows for augmented reality. So you can actually see the real world and things can be kind of placed into your field of vision. And the idea is that this is almost like a replacement phone or a replacement computer. And this is very much part of Apple's thinking. They are asking themselves, what could possibly replace the hugely lucrative iPhone? And this is one of the products that they think, oh, maybe this could replace it. I don't think executives are totally confident that this is going to be the next iPhone. But They need to have a product, and it certainly looks quite impressive. And one other thing to add, the price point, $3,500. That is an eye-watering amount. To put that into context, Meta, that has a new Quest 3 out, their price point for that is $500. So it's just so much more expensive than anything else. And I wonder how many people can actually afford this product.
Yeah, and if it doesn't take off, how much of a problem would that be for Apple?
Honestly, not that big a deal. it's one of those things where most companies, if they did launch a massive product like this and it flopped, it would be a disaster. I don't think it is going to be a disaster. Apple have unbelievably successful and profitable product lines. However, it would be embarrassing for Apple. They would also lose a lot of money that they've put into this. And I think it would be a real issue for Tim Cook, who he's always been a steady hand at the tiller. Good businessman, not known as an innovator. He came in 2011. I can think of one big product that Apple have launched since then, the Apple Watch in 2015. So if this kind of doesn't really work, I think people will be questioning what's going on here. Is Apple really an innovative company anymore? You know, already there's sort of more than murmurs of that. If this product isn't successful, I think those murmurs will become a little louder.
James Clayton at Apple headquarters near San Francisco. Afghanistan was already in a desperate state even before the Taliban returned to power in August 2021. But now millions there are affected by hunger, the economy has collapsed, and women's rights have vanished. According to Afghan doctors, there is also a catastrophic mental health crisis, leading to an increase in suicides, particularly among women and girls. The BBC's Yogita Lamai has travelled across Afghanistan to investigate, and a warning, some listeners may find her report distressing.
I'm in the city of Herat in the west of the country. It's Afghanistan's third largest city, and I'm on my way now to meet a young woman who attempted to take her own life a few months ago. We can't share where we're meeting her or identify her for safety reasons. But also, as is in most cultures, there is a stigma associated with suicide in Afghanistan.
Why did you feel that life had become unbearable for you?
Just staying at home without an education or a future, it feels ridiculous. I feel exhausted and indifferent to everything. Education is the only hope we had.
Tears rolled down her cheeks as she spoke. Her words give an insight into the mental health crisis plaguing Afghanistan, particularly its women. In a deeply patriarchal society that has gone through four decades of war, the UN estimates that one in two people, most of them women, suffered from psychological distress even before the Taliban took over. Now, as women's freedoms are clamped down on and amid an economic collapse, there's evidence that the situation is worse than ever before. We spoke to a teacher who tried to take her own life.
They closed universities for women, so I lost my job. I used to be the breadwinner of my family, and now I can't bear the expenses. That really affected me mentally. Because I was forced to stay at home, I was being pressurized to get married. All the plans I had for my future have been shattered. I feel totally disoriented, with no goals or hope.
We connected her with a doctor after this conversation. We also spoke to the families of six women and girls who've taken their own lives over the past year, all of whom said the ban on education and restrictions on work were the main triggers. The father of one girl agreed to be interviewed over the phone.
My daughter used to love school. She wanted to become a doctor. When schools were closed, she became very distressed and upset. But it was after she was not allowed to sit for the university entrance exam that is when she lost all hope and took her own life.
We started looking into this issue because we saw an increasing number of articles in the local news reporting suicides in different parts of the country. Partly because of the stigma associated with it, and partly because the Taliban aren't recording numbers, there are no official figures available. We've seen recent research which suggests two-thirds of Afghan adolescents mostly female but also male, suffer from depression in some parts of the country. And we've been asking numerous mental health professionals about their assessment of the scale of the crisis. In Kabul, I've come to a quiet location to meet with a female psychologist. We can't identify her. She's now getting multiple messages and requests for help every single day.
Now we have a pandemic of suicidal thoughts, mental health issues in Afghanistan, which rarely people talk about.
The Taliban government didn't respond to questions about a surge in suicides and psychological illnesses since they've come to power. They say they don't have suicide numbers.
Yogita Limai. And staying in Afghanistan, police in the northern province of Saripul have said around 60 girls are in hospital after being poisoned at their school. It follows a recent state of poison attacks on girls' schools in neighbouring Iran. As we heard on the Global News podcast recently, solar power is to overtake oil in terms of global investment this year. But it's not just about the money. The technology is also advancing. In a major breakthrough, a test satellite has transmitted and received wireless power in space for the first time. And it could lead to great gains in solar energy use here on Earth. Ali Hajimiri is the co-director of the space-based solar power project for the California Institute of Technology. He told Tim Franks how they did it.
The basic energy transfer over distance concept relies on using a large number of transmitters working in perfect synchronization. And that is what we've used to send energy to a desired location. And then by controlling the timing of these devices, we can actually change where the energy goes. And our experiment involves demonstrating this in space using flexible, lightweight structures that are conducive to a low-cost space mission for demonstration of energy transfer over distances in space and to Earth.
And what form does this energy take?
It is basically a form of microwave energy. You can send it as electromagnetic waves, like any other electromagnetic or radio waves, but you send it in a direction in a controlled fashion, so it basically goes to where you need and when you need and as much as you need.
What are the advantages of collecting solar energy in space?
So there are several advantages to that. One is that if you are in a high enough orbit, you can have access to the sun 24/7. On average, it gives you something about 8 times more total energy available to you because you don't have the cycles of day and night. You don't have the seasons, you don't have clouds, and you don't have the absorption in the atmosphere. So you start off with a lot more energy at your disposal. And then because of the fact that our system allows it to send it on demand to different locations, you can bypass and leapfrog this access to energy and the need for the infrastructure for power distribution on the ground.
The principle of that could be enormously powerful in itself, because am I right in thinking that you could then get it to places where, I mean, if, for example, there'd been some sort of natural disaster and all the power lines were down, you could conceivably get energy to those regions or to just very remote regions of the world?
Yes, that's exactly correct. I mean, disaster areas, war zone where the infrastructure is damaged, as well as places that basically do not have any power distribution infrastructure, a small sub-Saharan village in Africa or a research station above the Arctic Circle. All of those places where the power is hard to get to, you can send the energy to these places on demand.
What's the next step then? Are you hoping next to demonstrate that this can work at scale?
Yes, these three demonstrators that we have in space right now are just to demonstrate the core technology. And then the next step is working towards integration and scaling. And there are various interesting challenges that we are dealing with as we go. As you can imagine, when you scale something like this up, there are questions of timing, questions of size, question of launch vehicles and the structure. And those are exactly the things that we are trying to learn from these experiments and use that to inform our next phases of design.
Ali Hajimiri of the California Institute of Technology. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
His impact has been so singular. He brought so much more diversity to the magazine. What he was doing at British Vogue really influenced the rest of the industry, including runway shows, ad campaigns, and beyond that.
With the announcement of his departure, how Edward Enninful broke so many boundaries as editor of British Vogue. It's been a year since the British journalist Dom Phillips and Brazilian indigenous expert Bruno Pereira were murdered deep in the Amazon. Their bodies were hacked to pieces and hidden in the jungle, where they were found after a 10-day search. Events have been held in Brazil and London to mark the one-year anniversary of their deaths, even as new details continue to emerge about the case. I heard more from our Latin America regional editor, Phoebe Hobson.
These two men, Dom Phillips and Bruno Pereira, ventured into the Amazon to report on illegal fishing operations in this remote area. It's called the Javari Valley near the Colombian and Peruvian border. The reason this is significant is, you know, it's not just been a tragedy for the families of the two men who were murdered on their return, but also it's highlighted on a global stage just how dangerous the Amazon is in certain places. The killing of these two men really took the story of the Amazon outside of Brazil.
And the memory of their deaths has been kept alive by memorial events.
Across Brazil and in London, there have been memorial events held by fans of Dom Phillips and Bruno Pereira, environmental campaigners, and also the families of the two men. Dom Phillips lived in Brazil, and his widow, Alessandra Sampaio, was speaking earlier today in Rio de Janeiro. She's calling for justice for the two men, but she was also saying, you know, how long is the violence in the Amazon going to last, and saying that she herself had also received threats.
And tell us about the investigation, because new facts continue to emerge.
The investigation has been murky and it's been complicated. Just last week, two more suspects were charged with the murder of the two men, including a man who, it's widely reported in The Guardian, where Dom Phillips used to write, is thought to have ordered the killings. He's thought to have been in charge of an illegal fishing operation. Previously, three other men earlier on who are local fishermen. They're currently in custody awaiting trial next month. This investigation has further highlighted how complicated it is to operate in the Amazon, how difficult it is to monitor illegal activity such as deforestation or illegal fishing, which is what these men were investigating at the time. It's well known that sort of indigenous activists have been murdered in the Amazon, but they're not as high profile as these two men. Campaigners generally consider that Jair Bolsonaro sort of encouraged a spirit of lawlessness in the Amazon. People who wanted to exploit the Amazon for resources were really empowered and emboldened, and the state didn't have much power to stop these activities. President Lula has made very different promises to protect the Amazon, but he struggled to get things through Congress, and here we are a year on since the murders, and we still haven't had any sort of trial.
Our Latin America regional editor, Phoebe Hobson. The World Health Organization has announced plans for a global health certificate based on the COVID pass used by the European Union. The WHO says the digital certificate will help preserve global mobility and protect people from future pandemics. Imogen Folkes reports from Geneva.
During the pandemic, millions of European citizens became used to the COVID pass. Recognised and standardised across the European Union, the certificate showed an individual's vaccination records, negative test, or COVID recovery. Adopting the pass opened Europe up to travel again after months of lockdowns. Questions about data protection were addressed by ensuring the information on each certificate remained there and could not be stored by those checking it. Now the WHO plans to adopt the system worldwide. It believes a global health certificate could help protect us from future pandemics. A lack of adequate test and trace systems was a key factor in the rapid spread of COVID-19. Not everyone may welcome the idea of something that sounds like a digital health identity card, but the WHO insists privacy is key. The goal, the organisation says, is to make us all better equipped to face the inevitable next pandemic than we were the last one.
Imogen Folkes. The 7-week-long conflict in Sudan has had a profound human cost, with 1,800 people reported dead and more than 1 million forced from their homes. But the fighting has also taken a big toll on Sudan's economy, costing it an estimated $3.4 billion, according to the country's former finance minister, Ibrahim El-Badawi. I found out more from our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton.
Ibrahim El-Badawi said that the war had frozen international trade, that cargo ships were stuck at Port Sudan, that traders were unable to send money for goods, and there'd also obviously been damage to infrastructure and building and even damage to military assets. So here's a bit more of what he had to say.
My estimate is that slightly more than 1 month of high-intensity violence in the capital and major cities, I think probably have already destroyed 20% of the already impoverished Sudanese national product. It destroys supply chain because of the closure of the routes from the Port Sudan to the rest of the country. It actually destroyed the assets of the economy in the capital. So this is really a huge calamity.
He said that Sudan had turned into a country that was initially optimistic way back after independence, but it was defined by conflicts, by the military, by failed development and dysfunctional government. So pretty damning on the situation of the country now.
Now, the latest ceasefire expired on Saturday night. On Sunday, we saw an escalation in the fighting. What's been happening since then?
So this morning, there was shelling reported in western areas of Khartoum after the rival factions had been fighting through the night. There was also reported intense fighting across the adjoining cities because Khartoum sits across at the confluence of the Nile with Omdurman and Bari. One resident talked to the Reuters news agency. He said the neighbourhood where we live in the centre of Omdurman is looted daily. You can see them right in front of you taking cars, money, gold, whatever they can get their hands on. So this seems to be a pattern that the paramilitary is looting Khartoum and also water stations. They've taken control of some of those, so that's affecting the supply of water.
Richard Hamilton, our Africa regional editor. The appointment of Edward Enninful as the first black editor-in-chief of British Vogue was very high profile. So what should we make of his departure after 6 years in the job, compared to his predecessor's 25 years? When he spoke to the BBC recently, it sounded as if there was more he wanted to do with the magazine.
For me, British Vogue really, when you come into the pages of the magazine, you have to feel welcomed. And I always believe that if you can see it, you can be it. So if a young person doesn't see themselves reflected, it's very hard for them to think that they belong anywhere, especially the fashion industry. So for me, it's very paramount to show that the fashion industry can be inclusive.
Born in Ghana before moving to England, Edward Enninful has had a glittering career, and it was thought he might succeed Anna Wintour as editor of US Vogue. She has been involved in discussions about a new role that's being created for him at the magazine's publisher, Condé Nast. Amy O'Dell is a fashion journalist and author of Anna, the Biography. Michelle Hussain asked her what she thought was going on.
The age of the celebrity magazine editor has all but ended. Edward Enninful has been a cultural force beyond the fashion industry. He's hugely important in fashion at Vogue and for Condé Nast. But we've seen a lot of high-profile editors like this depart over the past, let's say, decade. And that's really just part of the magazine industry consolidating and continuing to cost cut, I think.
And yet, look at Anna Wintour, who's still very much there doing her job at US Vogue at the age of 73. Do you think that Edward Enninful was no longer seen by Condé Nast as someone who could take over from her?
There's been so much speculation about Edward and Anna, and I kind of think it's one of those situations where we'll never really know what was going on. But Anna's staying power is very unusual. She's really the last celebrity editor remaining, maybe arguably alongside David Remnick, the editor-in-chief of The New Yorker in the United States. But yeah, she's really the last one standing. It is quite remarkable.
Do you think he has also had a real impact on the industry and what he's been trying to do on diversifying the look, the disability issue he did recently and before that, using more women of colour, for example? Could that be said to be his legacy even after such a relatively short time in this job?
Absolutely. It's almost hard to remember what British Vogue was like before Edward Enninful because his impact has been so singular. And you're right that he brought so much more diversity to the magazine and also to fashion, because what he was doing at British Vogue really influenced the rest of the industry, including runway shows, ad campaigns, and even beyond that. I think also when I think of some of his big moments, Beyonce's Renaissance British Vogue cover, she's on tour now. She was recently in London performing. Edward has been part of so many big moments, and he created big moments, as you said, the covers featuring people with disabilities, but then he also did the absolutely breathtaking cover with African models, which was very, very meaningful to so many people and is something that people still talk about and just hold up as really memorable work, which it's just so hard to create that kind of work in fashion these days.
Amy O'Dell talking to Michelle Hussain. And you can see our recent interview with Edward Enninful on our Instagram account, at BBC Today programme. Gay sex was only decriminalised in the UK in 1967. Before then, it was illegal, and there was a whole slang language called polari to hide gay conversations. Many of the words are now in widespread use. They also feature in the lyrics of new sea shanties written by the choir Seaweed in the Fruit Locker. It will be the first LGBTQ plus sea shanty choir to perform at the International Sea Shanty Festival later this month in the southern English city of Falmouth. Rhys Morgan is the man behind the choir. He's been talking about it to Sarah Montague.
Polari is a form of slang or cant language that was used by lots of different groups, often marginalised communities. And then in the late 19th, early 20th century, it started to be used by queer people, largely gay men, as a way of communicating when their lifestyle was under persecution.
Right. It was coded language.
Yes, exactly, a coded language, yeah.
OK, so your choir is called Seaweed in the Fruit Locker. What does that mean?
Exactly. So Seaweed, it refers to a young, attractive and available gay sailor on a ship. And then a fruit locker is essentially a cabin on a ship where gay crew would maybe share cabins. But it was just a little fun way of kind of playing with polari and expressing the kind of broader vibe of the project, as it were.
Okay. And you've written sea shanties and I think involved other polari language.
That's right. A few of us in the group have now written completely new sea shanties or rewritten traditional sea shanties, which there's a long tradition in sea shanties of them being rewritten. It's kind of an oral history. And so they get changed and adapted over time. So we wanted to continue that and adapt them with a kind of contemporary queer lived experience. So there's one called Lion's Den, which I rewrote from a traditional sea shanty called Rio Grande. And that explores a space on the seafront on the Hoe in Plymouth, which was a former bathing area. And during the 20th century, it was a kind of notable cruising spot and potentially still is. And I wanted to kind of celebrate that in song. That has a lot of polari in it, that song, and a lot of the polari that's used translation is can be pretty yes, rum.
Let's use that seafaring term. Exactly.
It's farewell to you, all the girls of the town. Away to Lyons. You've got a half pocket to keep you around, and we're bound for the Lion's Den. And it's away, boys, away, away.
I was absolutely astonished to see how many words, which are now just mainstream, words like Barney or Ogle or Kazi.
Yeah.
Camp, butch, cottaging, they all come from polari.
And naff, naff's a common one, that comes from polari. And a lot of that kind of slippage from a coded language into more broad use happened in the 60s and 70s, well, more the 70s, bringing them into BBC sitcoms. And it started to kind of just broaden out into more general slang, which was really interesting.
Farewell and ahoy, my Bonnerack boys, and we're bound for the Lion's Den.
Rhys Morgan talking to Sarah Montague. That's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.